Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency released sweeping cyber incident reporting regulations yesterday. These are proposed rules. They would apply to hundreds of thousands of companies across 16 critical infrastructure sectors. The goal is to identify dangerous hacking campaigns that threaten everything from oil pipelines to hospitals. Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday joins me with the latest. And this rulemaking was anticipated, correct?
That's right. It's been anticipated for 2 years now. It was in March of 2022 that Congress passed the Cyber Incident Reporting for Critical Infrastructure Act, otherwise known as CERCIA. That's a fun acronym that you'll hear tossed around. CISA has spent the last 2 years developing these sweeping rules. The notice of proposed rulemaking is 447 pages, so it is extensive. By contrast, the Pentagon CMMC proposed rules were only about 230 pages, and that's not a simple rule itself either. It goes into how exactly this will work across 16 critical infrastructure sectors. A couple of the highlights is that there are about 316,000 organizations that CISA estimates this will apply to one day across those critical infrastructure sectors. And it expects in the first year of these rules becoming effective, which is projected to be 2026, it will receive about 25,000 cyber incident reports under the rules. So that's a lot of data, a lot of organizations that are going to be captured by these rules.
Which entities will have to report within a given sector?
Yeah, so the way that they scoped the covered entities, as they're called in this rule, was pretty important. It was one of the more closely watched things. What they're doing is they're defining those covered entities as any within one of the 16 critical infrastructure sectors that exceeds the small business size standards set by the Small Business Administration. So big is one of the big parameters here. And then outside of that, any of the critical infrastructure sectors entities that fall within sector-specific criteria that CISA sets in these rules. And that's one of the reasons this is so long, is across those 16 sectors, there's specific criteria. I'll pull one out as an example. In the IT sector, CISA is going to require any entity that provides hardware, software, or services to the federal government to require, is going to require them to report cyber incidents. That's just one example of sector-specific criteria.
And lest they get completely inundated with everything that happens every time you have a buffer overflow, what types of incidents are covered under the rules?
Yeah, that's right. CISA made it clear that they wanted to set a high threshold to prevent over-reporting, to make sure that routine or minor cyber incidents do not need to be reported. And so they've set kind of four broad parameters here for what kind of incidents need to be reported to CISA. The first parameter is when there's a substantial loss of confidentiality, integrity, or availability of an organization's system. So your internal network gets hacked and your whole internal system goes down. The next parameter is serious impact on the safety and resiliency of operational systems and processes. This is particularly important when you're talking about, you know, dams or water systems or something like that where there are control systems in play. The third parameter is the disruption of the ability to engage in business or industrial operations. There's been multiple ransomware hacks where, you know, maybe business systems were hacked, but then it resulted in an inability of the business, Colonial Pipeline, for example, to provide services. And finally, the last is unauthorized access, so hacking caused by the compromise of a cloud service provider, a managed service provider, or a third-party data hosting provider, aka a supply chain compromise. CISA wants to know about those as well.
Basically, when there's real damage to
aspect
of operating. And how is this actually going to work in practice? Because they need some codified way or some kind of a standardized way. Otherwise, it's, 1-800-TELL-CISA.
Yeah, that's right. They go into the rule. They talk about a web form that they're going to put out there. So unsurprisingly, cyber incidents are going to be reported over the web and not, you're not going to walk up to your local CISA office. And this web form will be released when the final rule is released about 18 months from now. So this, again, is just a proposed rule, and CISA is going to get a whole lot of comments, go through them, adjudicate them, and then release some of the technology infrastructure that's going to support that in a couple of years.
It sounds like just the mere reporting and the requirement to do that is a little bit less onerous than some of the rules coming, say, for CMMC, where you have to have certain controls in place, prove them, attest to them, have somebody third party go say, yeah, you're okay, you're kosher. This seems a little bit less of a regime, maybe.
That's right. I think, you know, it's important to note that this isn't giving the government or any sort of third party access to systems and, like you said, sort of complying with any standards or anything like that beyond just telling CISA, reporting to them certain information, indicators of compromise when you have some sort of cyber incident that meets the parameters that we've already discussed. At the same time, these are very sweeping rules affecting hundreds of thousands of organizations across the country, and they're going to have to make some, you know, game time decisions as these incidents are unfolding in terms of, does it meet the parameters, and hey, what do we have to tell CISA here under these rules?
And is it considered a major rule in terms of cost, such that it has to go up to the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs?
That's right. It had to go through OIRA review, and so it actually spent the last few months going through that review before CISA released the notice.
And what are the teeth? That is to say, penalties if you don't report something, and then all of a sudden your customers are locked out.
Yeah, the main teeth in this rule is the subpoena power that CISA has. They can issue a subpoena to any organization that doesn't comply with the rules. Now, CISA will start out by, if they suspect, you know, you're a water system that was hacked and you haven't told them anything yet, they're going to issue what's called a request for information, a little less, you know, perhaps aggressive than a subpoena. But then if you don't respond to that, or you don't respond to that adequately per these rules, CISA says that it will issue a subpoena. And if you don't respond to that, then CISA says it will refer you to the Attorney General for potential civil action. For government contractors, this is also interesting. The rules lay out the potential for suspension and debarment if that might be the case where you're a government contractor who doesn't report a cyber incident. And then there's also the False Claims Act. If you lie or otherwise misrepresent what's happened in an incident, that also comes into play here.
I guess a failure to report could be construed as a false claim in some sense.
Yeah, failure to report or you know, saying, hey, this wasn't that big of a deal, and then it comes out 6 months later that actually was.
And we've talked earlier that there's OIRA has been reviewing lots of rules. There's DOD rules coming out. There's GSA possible cybersecurity regulations. Is anybody like OIRA somewhere, OMB, saying, can we get all this kind of harmonized in some kind of a system that's cogent for the tens of thousands of entities that are going to have to bear the cost?
Yeah, that's a key watchword, harmonization here. CISA and the Department of Homeland Security say they are committed to harmonizing these rules with other regulations out there. There's a DHS Cyber Incident Reporting Council that pulls in a whole lot of federal agencies, and that's kind of the main avenue through which this harmonization will happen. And in this proposed rule, CISA says it will seek to create an exception where if substantially similar information is reported to another federal entity, then they will say, hey, you're okay. You don't have to report to us under our rules. And the important thing there is that CISA has to set up some interagency agreements to make sure that they at least know when something happens. So that sort of interagency behind the scenes sort of minutia will be pretty important to watch here as well.
Well, we know what people are going to be reading over Easter weekend. What's the comment period and what's the schedule for this rule?
Yeah, the rule actually formally gets published in the Federal Register on April 4th, but you can read it now, as you said, and comments are due by June 3rd, so stay tuned.
Federal News Network's Justin Doubleday. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And be sure to check out his story at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down, so I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era, to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're, thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah, and worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.